crackers on while I pour. Baby, it's bad out there. Say what's in this no drink? Cabs to be had.
Hello, my name is Norma Goodson, and I'd like to welcome you to this edition of the East Devon Talking Newspaper magazine, being recorded at the Dissenters Hall in Sidmouth. Before we begin, I'd like to welcome your readers, Diana Crowther, Anne-Marie Irish, Geoffrey Ogden, Jeremy Tanner and Gerald Wealdon. Your producer today is Sam Clark, and the registrar is Wendy Eadles. One of our regular readers, Gillian Crooks, cannot be with us today. I'm sure we all wish her a speedy recovery after an accident. Just for your information, your curtains can be opened at any time after 6:51 in the morning and closed at any time before 17:03 in the evening. If you have any problems with your equipment, please phone this mobile number, which is checked regularly, 07552 766 382. We'll now move on to a new magazine for the winter season. We've tried to bring you a variety of articles as our thoughts are turning to winter and the Christmas season, the season of giving. With this in mind, we have included two interviews from people who work for charities. We also explore the themes of winter and the festive season by sharing some of our favourite Christmas music and reading three famous poems, all in different styles. So, on with this edition. We begin with our first interview with Simon Card, who explains the work of the Devon Air Ambulance. You might recognise Simon's voice. He is also one of our regular readers. Hello, Simon. Thank you for spending time with me today. I know you're involved with fundraising for the Devon Air Ambulance, and today we hope to learn more about this from you. Can you tell us what triggered your interest in the Devon Air Ambulance?
Hello, Norma. It's a pleasure to be talking to you. The Air Ambulance, I've always been a volunteer throughout my business life, and we moved down from Buckinghamshire in 2011 to run a bed and breakfast for a lifestyle change. On the centre of the table in the dining room was a collecting can for Devon Air Ambulance. And I thought about, well, what can I do? So when Don came to collect the can, I said, what can I do? And he put me in touch with the headquarters of the Air Ambulance. And they said, what are your skills? What can you do? And I said, well, I can't do very much. But I have done a bit of public speaking in my time. And they said, OK, right, well, you can do some talking for us. OK, that's great. So I've been doing talks for the Air Ambulance now for over 12 years. It's a wonderfully enjoyable experience. And I met some really interesting people across that time.
Okay, and can you tell me, is the Air Ambulance purely a charitable endeavour?
Yes, it is, absolutely. The charity itself gets no government funding at all. It gets the odd government grant, and it gets no national lottery funding. It's purely a charity. It's been going for 30-odd years now, and is a very important part of Devon life. You never know when you might need it, but the funding itself has to be raised from the people of Devon and beyond to make sure that it works. It costs us about £12 to £14 million a year to run the two helicopters across the county. We now have four critical care cars as well, so the whole cost of it is about, say, £14 million, and that has to be raised through the good services of people in Devon and the businesses of Devon as well. But we are definitely a charity, and that's why we work so hard at what we do.
Okay, thank you. You said your role involved some public speaking. What exactly is your role?
I'll do anything that's legal, decent and honest as far as the charity is concerned. And so I do a whole range of things. Last week, for example, I was in Honiton with the Honiton Young Farmers, who are great supporters of the charity. I collected a cheque from them for £6,000, and they gave me dinner as well, which was rather exciting. But the important thing is that that we get no government money, so we have to rely on people like the Young Farmers to come and provide the money for us. We call those grip and grins, where you grip the cheque and you grin at the camera. And I've done many of those over the years, although we're getting less and less of the larger cheques that we used to get. So the cheques are quite small, but we still grip the cheque and we still grin at the camera. Apart from that, I do many other things. I'll just say I do anything that's legal, decent and honest, so I will attend the county show, for example, and help on the stall there. And I'm involved now on the development board of the charity, and we're looking at how we approach the high net worth individuals within the county of Devon to see if we can approach them more effectively to get more money out of them as far as the service is concerned. The service itself covers the whole of the county, obviously, but we can we've airlifted people from the age of literally hours old, a youngster who had heart conditions, to the Bristol Children's Hospital, and the oldest patient we airlifted was 102, so anywhere in between. You never know when you might need the service itself. So I will get involved in doing anything. I collect money wherever it's available. I give talks right across the county to anywhere between dozens of talks a year. I may be talking to a care home one minute and a school the next. One of the interesting things about schools are you get 200 children in front of you and you talk to them and they're always scratching each other's noses or poking each other in the eye or doing whatever they do. There was an occasion in Honiton Primary School when there was a young lad on the right who was desperate to ask a question. So I said to him, what's your question? He said, well, what's the weight of a rotor blade on a helicopter? And I said, I have absolutely no idea what the weight of a rotor blade on a helicopter is. Anyway, I found out it's something over 38 kilograms. And after that, I fed the information back to the school, and they did a fundraising on the back of that, by doing all sorts of wear a hat day or silly costume day.
And do you wear the hat or the silly costume?
I'll wear anything, basically.
Okay.
going way back to give a bit of background, before we moved down here, I was honorary town crier for a village we lived at in Buckingham. We lived in Buckinghamshire, and I used to do Father Christmas across many years. So I love dressing up, basically, so it's not a problem as far as I'm concerned.
Fantastic. And can you tell those of us who don't know some more detail about the work of the air ambulance?
The great thing about the air ambulance, Norma, is that we can fly across the whole of the county from the two air bases within about 10 or 15 minutes. It's very important in a critical situation where an air ambulance is needed that the what they call a golden hour makes a huge difference to the outcome of a patient. Mm. And the two air bases, one at Exeter Airport and one at Eaglescott in North Devon, is where we operate from. The helicopter is hugely well equipped. It's much better to be picked up by an air ambulance than a land ambulance. We have specialist equipment. The paramedics are well trained. They will do actually many operations on the roadside, which they can't do from a land ambulance. They carry plasma and blood, so they can give blood transfusions if necessary. They have an amazing piece of kit called a Lucas CPR machine. This is a machine that wraps around the body of a patient, giving constant CPR all the time, whilst the paramedics are working on the patient in other parts of their body, should they need to be doing that. It's a vital piece of work, run over 30 years now, started not far from here. I live in Sidmouth, and they started in a house just up the road here in Sidbury, where Anne Thomas' son sadly passed away following a bicycle accident. And she said to the surgeons at the hospital, what could I have done to save his life? And they said, just get him to hospital sooner. It's the speed of action that the air ambulance does that makes a huge difference to people's outcome. They fly at 150 miles per hour. They can fly over snow and over floods, whereas land ambulances aren't very good at doing that. So they make a huge difference. On board we have a pilot who's rather useful, and we have a paramedic and a doctor, or two paramedics or two doctors. The aircraft itself seats five people. We have a new one which we bought a few years ago. They cost quite a lot of money, several million pounds to buy them. But before that, we used to lease one helicopter and buy the other. If you buy a helicopter, you save the leasing costs of £12,000 a month. And the helicopter itself, if you buy it, has a residual value. So we can trade it on and trade up every few years to get the latest equipment. It's a vital service and we're very proud to be part of it. We have something like 700 volunteers. We have 20 shops now across the county, and many of your listeners will know a shop near them where they can go and buy some really good quality products.
And is there anything else that other people can do to help and to get involved with the air ambulance?
Yes, I think the answer is support them in any way you can, particularly with the shops. The shops provide a really good service with lots of really good quality products. And as I say, they're spread across the county. They will take goods in as well as sell you goods as well. Mm-hmm. The other thing that is very important, we get no national lottery funding. So we have our own lottery. For £1 a week, you can win £1,350 per week, if you're lucky. And it goes towards the air ambulance service, every penny. Part of the administration costs goes to the air ambulance. Over 70%, 75% of the money raised in the lottery goes directly to the front line, which is exactly the opposite to the national lottery, where about 75% of the national lottery goes in running with the lottery and the prizes. We are completely the opposite way around, and therefore more money goes to the service directly from the lottery itself. So those are two specific ways in which people can help and contribute to the running of the air ambulance service here in Devon.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. I'm afraid today that's all we've got time for, but I'm sure all our listeners wish you every good luck, and we wish the air ambulance well into the future.
Thank you very much, Norma.
Hello, it's Geoffrey. We're recording this magazine shortly after Remembrance Sunday, so we thought we'd look back to the origin of this. Remembrance Sunday in the United Kingdom is held on the second Sunday of November and commemorates British service members who have died in wars and other military conflicts since the onset of World War I. By tradition, a two-minute period of silence is observed through the country at 11 a.m, and church services and other ceremonial gatherings take place during the day. A nationally televised remembrance service, generally attended by politicians, religious leaders, military personnel and members of the British royal family, have been held for decades at the Cenotaph Monument in central London. The day has its origins in Armistice Day, which was dedicated in Great Britain on November 11th, 1919, in commemoration of the one-year anniversary of the peace agreement that ended World War I. In response to a politician's suggestion, King George V requested that the country pause in silence for 2 minutes in acknowledgement of the war's fatalities. Thereafter, a period of silence became the centrepiece of Armistice Day events that occurred annually until the outbreak of World War II in 1939, when it was decided that general celebrations would not be held on November 11th of that year. Instead, Sunday was observed as a day of dedication during the span of the war. After the conclusion of World War II, the British government, seeking to honour participants in both world wars, officially replaced Armistice Day with the new Sunday observance, which was thereafter known as Remembrance Sunday. In 1956, the date was fixed as the second Sunday of the month. In recent years, Armistice Day has been revived as an additional occasion of silence, though Remembrance Sunday remains the main day of commemoration. The most recognisable symbol in Remembrance Sunday is the red poppy, which became associated with World War I memorials after scores of the flowers bloomed in the former battlefields of Belgium and northern France. The phenomenon was depicted in the popular 1915 poem In Flanders Fields by Canadian soldier John McCrae. In 1921, the newly formed British Legion, now the Royal British Legion, a charitable organisation for veterans, began selling red paper poppies for Armistice Day, and its annual poppy appeal has been enormously successful since. In addition to poppies intended to be worn on clothing, wreaths made of poppies are frequently displayed at memorial sites. Beginning in the 1930s, some groups have alternatively promoted white poppies as an emblem of peace, though this has often been met with controversy. Days similar to Remembrance Sunday are still celebrated on November the 11th in other countries such as the United States, Veterans Day, and Australia, Canada and France, Remembrance Day.
Hello, Jeremy here. We now turn our thoughts to another aspect of the winter season. Where do animals go during the long, cold, dark winter? In the long winter's nights make you want to sleep forever, curl up or head somewhere warmer. You're not alone. Winter is a time where many animals conserve their energy, fly south, or grow a thicker coat. Winter is a challenging period for some of the UK's wildlife, especially for those that are small. Food is scarce, temperatures are low, and animals need to conserve the energy they have to survive. Not all animals hunker down. Some grow a dense winter coat. Others migrate to warmer climes where food is easier to find, and the odd few even shrink their bodies to get through the leaner months. Hedgehogs build nests. Hedgehogs often choose leaf litter and logs as places to build their nests, using dry leaves, grass, and other vegetation to help keep out the cold. To make sure they have enough body fat to last the winter, they must consume enough food before the cold weather arrives. Young hedgehogs usually need to reach a body weight of around 500 grams or more to survive the colder months. That's about the weight of a loaf of bread. Hoglets born late in the year can struggle to put on enough weight to see them through the winter. The start and end of their hibernation season depends on the weather, but hedgehogs are usually inactive between November and mid-March. Dormice settle in for the winter. Dormice curl their tails over their faces when dormant and sometimes even snore. The hazel or common dormouse spend a long time being dormant. They are usually inactive between November and April, although sometimes they don't wake up until May. This long dormancy is likely why their name is derived from the French word dormir, meaning to sleep. These tiny rodents live in woodlands, hedgerows and scrub, and are mostly found in the south of the UK. In summer, they sleep during the day and are active at night, roaming around looking for berries, insects and nuts. They are currently classed as endangered. Shrews and moles shrink themselves to save energy. In winter, this shrew will shrink in size by as much as 20%. Shrews and moles have a remarkable way to get through winter. They shrink themselves. In fact, shrews can even shrink their skulls by as much as 20%. And they don't stop at the bones. They also shrink their organs and brain too. In winter, shrews spend less time running around and more time eating, drinking and walking. Shrews use so much energy that they are constantly in need of food. If they don't find any food for 2 hours, they could die. Moles also shrink themselves, sometimes by up to 11% to save on energy. When the weather warms up, shrews and moles will expand their bodies and grow again. Bats save energy over winter. All of the UK's bat species hibernate. Some stop being active in November, but most will be inactive from December through to at least March. If the weather gets colder, once they've become active again, they might enter a state known as torpor. Like hibernation, torpor also involves reducing body temperature and metabolism to save energy, but it occurs over shorter periods, such as overnight. By May, bats will be fully active again. Snakes and reptiles slow down. Snakes and lizards are mostly inactive during the winter in the UK. At this time of year, sunlight doesn't provide them with the warmth and energy they need, so they slow down and spend the winter months in a sheltered spot, barely moving. These reptiles might choose leaf litter, rock crevices, or even an old tire as their winter home. Swallows fly south to warmer climes. Swallows leave the UK in autumn. If you can fly away to a warmer place, why wouldn't you? Swallows do just that, spending their summers in the UK and then packing up and flying south when it starts to get cold. Swallows from the UK spend around 6 weeks making the long journey south to Namibia or South Africa. Unlike the swallow, other birds, including some geese, actually arrive in the UK for winter, as it's warmer than their summer homes in Scandinavia or the Arctic. My friends the turnstones also fly away for the winter. They come down to Sidmouth, flying from as far as the Arctic.
Hello everyone, I'm Gerald, and it is time for our recipe section. We begin with a seasonal basic mincemeat. Again, these recipes have all been developed for people with sight challenges. Ideally, the raisins, sultanas and currants for this recipe should have been soaking in brandy, port or sherry for weeks or possibly months, but even a couple of days will help. The dried fruit can be put into separate jars, covered with brandy. Make sure they can be identified. Christmas mincemeat. You can make a stock of mincemeat for the whole year when the apples are falling, and it makes great presents too. 340 grams of raisins, 170 grams of currants, 170 grams of sultanas, brandy, sherry or port to cover, 170 grams of glacé cherries, halved, 450 grams prepared weight cooking apples, peeled, cored and diced, 170 grams of suet, which can be vegetarian, 340 grams of dark brown sugar or honey, 2 oranges, zest and juice, 2 lemons, zest and juice, 110 grams of almonds, chopped or flaked, 4 heaped teaspoons of ground mixed spice, 1/2 teaspoon of ground cinnamon, 1/2 of nutmeg, grated, additional brandy for potting, which is optional. Mix all the ingredients together in a large oven-proof bowl or pan. Place the bowl in a preheated oven at 95 degrees centigrade, gas slow or 1/4, 200 degrees F for 3 hours. After stirring, the mix should reach at least 76 degrees C in the centre. Cool and stir in the additional brandy if using. Place in sterilised jars and seal. My tips: a tropical version can be made by reducing the weight of currants, sultanas and raisins soaked in rum, but when making the mix, adding dried mango, crystallized or dried pineapple, dried coconut, dates, etc. Add a couple of heaped tablespoons to a simple apple crumble. Use the savoury tart pastry recipe to make mince pies.
Hello, it's Diana here, and our next recipe is for chocolate shards. If you struggle to get out Christmas shopping, here's a quick and easy recipe that would make a present for someone. You can use milk or dark chocolate depending on your preference, but dark chocolate is healthier. This is because it contains magnesium and iron and also is a rich source of antioxidants, which help to boost the immune system. The higher the cocoa percentage, 70% or more, is the best type I recommend using. This recipe is taken from 4 Ingredients Easy Christmas Recipes by Kim McCosker. Ingredients: 1. 200 grams of milk or dark chocolate. 2. Whatever toppings you want to use, such as chopped or whole nuts, goji berries, freeze-dried raspberries, or hundreds and thousands. Method: 1. Melt 200 grams of milk or dark chocolate in a microwave on high power in 30-second increments until nice and smooth. I use a microwave-proof jug and test with a spatula each time to feel if it had melted or not. Once melted, pour the chocolate onto a baking tray that you have lined with a greaseproof paper. 3. Sprinkle on with your topping. I used whole hazelnuts. And then place in the fridge for 15 minutes or until set. 4. Cut or break into random shards. 5. Place into Christmassy cellophane bags and tie them with a bow. 6. Store them in a cool place until they're ready to give as a present.
Hello, I'm Anne-Marie. Now for an all-time favourite, the trifle. This is a simplified version of the trifle which was developed for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. Lemon Swiss roll and amaretti trifle. This will serve approximately 6 people. 1 ready-made, ingredients. 1 ready-made lemon loaf cake. 400 grams of ready-made custard. A jar of lemon curd. 2 120 gram pots of ready-made jelly, lemon or lime if possible. 100 grams of amaretti biscuits. 150 mils of double cream, or extra thick double cream if you prefer not to whip it yourself. To decorate, it's up to you how you choose to decorate your trifle. The method. Choose your favourite medium-sized trifle bowl, ideally glass, so the layers of the trifle might be seen through it. Cut the lemon cake into slices about 1 centimetre thick and spread lemon curd onto the slices, sandwiching them together as if making sandwiches. Place the lemon curd sandwiches in the bottom of the trifle bowl. Tip the jelly pots into a small bowl and mash them slightly with a fork in order to break it up a little. Then tip this onto the cake base in the trifle and spread it to form your jelly layer. Pour your custard on top of the jelly layer. Arrange a layer of amaretti biscuits on top of the custard. Whip the double cream into soft peaks. Do not overwhip it. Spoon the whipped cream onto the top of the trifle and smooth down as evenly as possible. Decorate with decorations of your choice. Lemon rind or dark chocolate are suggestions. And now, as promised, our second interview. I would like to introduce you to Martin Swallow, who will enlighten us about the work of the Citizens Advice Bureau.
Well, hello, Martin, and thank you for meeting me today. Now, I know full well that you volunteer for the Citizens Advice Bureau, and that's what we hope to inform our listeners about today. So thank you very much. Your first question is, how many times a week do you work for the Citizens Advice Bureau?
I work 2 sessions a week on a regular basis, and I do an additional session every other week where I wear a Citizens Advice hat, but I work from the food bank and help people there.
Thank you. And in case of any misunderstandings, and I think there sometimes are a few, what exactly is the role of the CAB?
Well, we give independent, impartial and confidential advice to anyone, and it's free at the point of contact.
Okay. And bearing in mind confidentiality, which I know is very important, what are the types of issues you encounter regularly? Do you find there are any particular issues at the moment?
Yes, our staple diet, I would say about 60% of our work is debt and benefits, or benefits and debt. Then everything else just falls into line. But money, we do relationship issues. We're not legal, we give generalist advice and not specialist advice, but we cover all subjects.
And do you sometimes find people think you can give legal advice instead of going to lawyers?
Yes, quite often, in actual fact. But I don't give legal advice and I wouldn't give medical advice. I'd say you need a doctor or you need a lawyer once we've gone so far.
Quite, but I think that's worth clearing up for any misunderstandings. Did you receive any particular training to do this work?
Yes, there is a lot of training, which when I started, I thought I knew quite a bit, but I was soon disabused of that. There's a lot of training. Mine was very enjoyable. And once you've passed the objectives, you are supervised initially when you see clients face to face or nowadays call them up on the phone.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about yourself, if you don't mind? What was your career before you became involved with the Citizens Advice Bureau?
Well, I left school and I've been in transport and distribution for decades before I retired. I spent half my career in the army and the other half in commercial life. I went into semi-retirement in my mid-late 50s and bought a tea rooms and restaurant. And since then, I've just moved around working for various charities and settled on Citizens Advice.
Okay. And obviously, the Citizens Advice Bureau is a charity.
It is a charity. We're completely reliant on funds. We get most of our funds from local authorities. We're greatly appreciative of clients who come in and leave money in the collecting boxes. Times are getting hard, as has been evinced recently by Exeter Citizens Advice Bureau. Their funding dropped from just over £200,000 to £75,000, and there were redundancies there, and they've had to move offices to a less expensive place.
So how can other people help you with the Citizens Advice Bureau to keep it going?
Other people can help by... if you've had a good experience, you've been to advice, tell your local MP, tell your councillors. We are very heavily reliant on local authorities, and ask people if they come and see us to put some money in the collecting box.
Well, thank you, Martin. And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. But thank you to you and all the other volunteers at Citizens Advice Bureau.
Thank you. As just a final advert, if anybody would like to volunteer, we're now looking for people who would just sit with clients and fill in forms for them and take a start slowly. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Martin.
Hello, this is Diana here with a roundup of your local sport for, well, the start of winter 2024. Sidmouth and Ottery Hockey Club have been awarded funding to purchase junior face masks. This equipment will be used by younger members of the club during matches and tournaments to ensure their safety when taking short corners. One of the players said, "It is so reassuring to have face masks. I feel much safer now." England Hockey strongly recommends the use of face masks for all age groups and playing formats when defending a penalty corner. However, due to their high costs, not all parents can afford to buy them. And Katie Dean, the playing committee chair, said, "It is so important that all our junior club members get the chance to play in all positions, and the purchase of the masks makes this possible for all young members. We are very grateful to the Keith Owen Fund for their support of the club." Now, here is a bit of news about the Sidmouth Running Club members who've achieved a record time for the 66K run from Exmouth to Lyme Regis. Donna and Graham Walmsley Westlake, the club's junior run leaders, completed the East Devon Way route in the fastest known time for a self-supported mixed couple. Meanwhile, the run leader, Clive Gilbert, took a group of members known as the Mighty Greens on a 12-mile loop round West Hill and Ottery St Mary, passing the famous Ottery Bonfire. Other members of the club supported the Sidmouth 10K event, either by running or marshalling. The event, starting at Sidford Village Social Hall, follows a route through the byes, up hillside and down Beetlands, ending at the seafront before participants retrace their steps. Despite the challenge of two steep hills, Mighty Green Toby Garrick finished seventh overall in a field of 266. He was the first Sidmouth male to cross the finish line. His mother, Naomi Garrick, was the first Sidmouth female to finish, and Colin Ryan finished in his age category, finished second in his age category, while Scott Chowan managed to cut 5 minutes off his previous year's time, despite being caught on camera walking up a hill. The rugby season is now well underway, and Sidmouth Rugby Football Club clinched an away victory against Wooden Bassett, 12-13. The match began with Sidmouth dominating possession for the first 15 minutes, sticking to their attacking plan and executing well. However, Royal Wooden Bassett's defence held strong and both teams were unwilling to concede much ground. Sidmouth was reduced to 10 men early on after Phil Dolman received a yellow card for a high tackle. Royal Wooden Bassett capitalised on this and scored the first points of the match, taking a 7-0 lead at half-time. The second half mirrored the first, with Sidmouth again enjoying plenty of possession. They secured their first points with Sean Moulton scoring a try after a well-worked phase. With the wind seemed to be in the Sidmouth sails, pressure led to a second try for Moulton, although the kick was unsuccessful, and Sidmouth's dominance continued, leading to a yellow card for Royal Wooden Bassett for multiple warnings at the breakdown. Royal Wooden Bassett managed to fight back, and a well-executed crossfield kick resulted in a try for their winger. The score at 12-10 to the home side, and only 10 minutes left, Sidmouth showed resilience and returned to the Royal Bassett try line, where they created an attacking opportunity but failed to convert on a 3-on-1 out wide. In the dying minutes of the game, a kick exit that didn't make touch was well returned by Sam Heathcott, who made great yards into the Royal Bassett Wooden Bassett half. From that breakdown, a cynical penalty from Royal Wooden Bassett gave man of the match Phil Dolman a chance to win it from 45 metres straight in front of the posts, which he duly converted. And with 30 seconds left on the clock, Sidmouth stole a Royal Wooden Bassett line out and managed to get the ball off the pitch, securing a hard-earned victory on the road. And now to a bit of local football with news about the Devon Premier Cup. Budley are out, but Beer, through penalties, are still in. Dartmouth 4, Budley Salterton 0. Budley Salterton went to Dartmouth in the Devon Premier Cup with a new man in charge, but they were well beaten 4-0 by the home side. Stu Tuckett was taken over as first team manager after Simon Pearce decided to stand down last week. A statement from the club read that all at Budley Salterton Football Club would like to put on record a big thank you to Simon for his contribution over the last 3 years. He came in at a difficult time for the club and built some key foundations that have allowed us to move forward. Stu Tuckett will step up to the first team interim manager, while Mark Baitup continues to manage the reserves as the club reviews its management plan going forward. Dartmouth went 1-0 ahead from a penalty shot, and they were 2 goals to the good before the break. Budley did have chances throughout the game, with players testing the home goalkeeper. But Dartmouth made it 3-0 following a corner on the hour, and they completed the scoring when the ball was headed home after a cross. In the other Premier Cup tie, Topsham Town 2, Beer Albion 2. Beer win 4-1 on penalties. Beer Albion through to the next round of the same competition, although it went penalties shootout. The Fishermen missed a penalty and 3 easy chances in the first 15 minutes, and then conceded 2 goals despite being much the better team. Beer did create chances to win the game, and what had looked to be a good goal was ruled out for offside. 15 minutes into the second half, they pulled a goal back when Taylor Brook guided across into the far corner, and 10 minutes later it was all square as Charlie Ledger fired home from a corner. Beer then created chances to win the game and had what looked to be a good goal ruled out for offside. It was a close run match with Beer winning on penalties. And lastly, some news on local point-to-point season. The first fixture of the Devon and Cornwall area was hosted by Dunsmore Racing Club at Dunsmore near Silverton on November the 10th. This event marks the beginning of 22 scheduled fixtures in the region until June next year. For those who are new to point-to-pointing, it resembles professional hunt racing, but offers a more relaxed atmosphere. The sport provides a family-friendly day out at a reasonable cost. Spectators can enjoy good close-up views of the parade ring and the jumps, and point-to-point racing is seen as one of the last remaining amateur sports, yet it is properly regulated by the British Horse Racing Authority. The point-to-point authority oversees the sport, ensuring it meets the necessary standards. Most point-to-point races cover 3 miles and include about 18 fence jumps, and this form of racing serves as a training ground for many jockeys, with over 70% of those currently riding under rules having begun their careers on the point-to-point events. Many famous winners of the Cheltenham Gold Cup and the Grand National have also come from this route. Pony racing will be featured at some meetings starting in February, providing a platform for aspiring young riders. The current champion jockey, Harry Cobden, began his journey in pony racing. Betting opportunities abound with numerous bookmakers present at the events. Each fixture includes various trade stands, and attendees can enjoy food and drinks or bring their own picnic. Dogs are welcome, provided they are kept on a lead. And while there is no strict dress code, outdoor clothing is recommended for the winter alongside suitable footwear. A race card is available to purchase upon arrival, as it includes a form guide. Upcoming fixtures in Devon and Cornwall to note include the East Cornwall Foxhounds on November the 24th and the Cornwall Hunt Club on December the 8th.
Anne-Marie here. We now have a complete change of subject. Christmas is approaching very quickly. We now move on to thinking about this. We are going to read 3 famous Christmas poems with totally different styles. First of all, Gerald will read A Visit from St. Nicholas.
It's Gerald with A Visit from St. Nicholas by Clement Clark Moore. 'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung up the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprung from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, to reopen the shutters and threw up the cat sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the lustre of midday objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be Saint Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Prancer and Vixen. On, Comet, on, Cupid, on, Dunder and Blixen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As dry leaves before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. With the sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas too, and then in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys was flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed, like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him, in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying a finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprung to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
And now it's Geoffrey with a poem by Rudyard Kipling. Eddie's Service. Eddie, priest at St. Wilfrid, in his chapel at Manhood End, ordered a midnight service for such as cared to attend. But the Saxons were keeping Christmas, and the night was stormy as well. Nobody came to service, though Eddie rang the bell. "Wicked weather for walking," said Eddie of Manhood End, "but I must go on with the service for such as care to attend." The older lamps were lighted, and old Marsh Donkey came, bold as a guest invited, and stared at the guttering flame. The storm beat on at the windows, the water splashed on the floor, and a wet, yoke-weary bullock pushed in through the open door. "How do I know what is greatest? How do I know what is least? That is my father's business," said Eddie, Wilfrid's priest. "But three are gathered together. Listen to me and attend. I bring good news, my brethren," said Eddie of Manhood End. And he told the ox of a manger and a stall in Bethlehem, and he spoke to the ass of a rider that rode to Jerusalem. They steamed and dripped in the chancel. They listened and never stirred, while just as though they were bishops, Eddie preached them the word. Till the gale blew off on the marshes, and the window showed the day, and the ox and the ass together wheeled and clattered away. And when the Saxons mocked him, said Eddie of Manhood End, "I dare not shut his chapel on such as care to attend."
Hi, it's Jeremy. I would now like to read a dramatic monologue by T.S. Eliot. This focuses upon the famous biblical story of the three kings from the east travelling to Bethlehem to pay homage to the baby Jesus. He imagines one of the kings giving in the account of the journey. T.S. Eliot describes an arduous journey. After arriving at the destination, they are deeply affected and changed by their experience. The birth heralded a new start and a new order and a new truth. Yet the kings have to return to their kingdoms and to an alien people clutching their gods. The journey of the Magi. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of the year. For a journey, and such a long journey, the ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melted snow. There were times we regretted the summer palaces on slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camel men cursing and grumbling, and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters, and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly, and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end we preferred to travel all night, sleeping in snatches, with the voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and a water mill beating the darkness, and three trees on the low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with vine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins. But there was no information, and so we continued. And arriving at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place, it was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again, but set down, were we led all the way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. This birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here, in the old dispensation with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death.
Anne-Marie here. Our readers have turned their thoughts to Christmas music as well. In the next few readings, we share our favourite Christmas music and explain the history behind the music.
Hello, it's Geoffrey again, and I enjoy listening to Mike Oldfield's version of In Dulce Jubilo. The single was not just Oldfield's first UK top five hit, but has become a part of the sound of Christmas in his home country. Mike Oldfield has always been chiefly an album artist, but that doesn't mean he hasn't had several moments of glory on the singles chart. One of them was not just his first UK top five single, but has become a part of the sound of Christmas in his home country. The jaunty instrumental In Dulce do Jubilo into the British bestsellers on December the 20th, 1975. In Dulce Jubilo translates as In Sweet Rejoicing. The song, usually with words, originally from a combination of German and Latin, was popular throughout Europe in various incarnations through the centuries. There were two separate 19th century translations of the lyrics into English, firstly by composer Robert Lucas de Purcell, and then by priest, scholar and hymn writer John Mason Neal. Oldfield recorded his version specially for the Virgin Records single release, which came out officially as a double A-side, On Horseback. The closing track from his then just released third album, Ormadon, was listing alongside it. The single debuted on the UK charts at number 42. The album, which held at number 16 that week, climbed back into the top 10 at number 9 on the final chart of the year. Although it had a festive air, In Dulce Jubilo wasn't a Christmas melody as such, so its appeal spread well into the new year of 1976, when it peaked at number 4 in mid-January, as Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody came towards the end of its run at number 1. The experience was such a success that Oldfield repeated it the following year, with another instrumental single for the Christmas market, Portsmouth. That was an even bigger hit, reaching number 3 and winning a silver disc.
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and a new one just begun.
It's Gerald. One of my favourite songs is Happy Christmas, War is Over by John Lennon. So This Is Christmas is perhaps one of the most famous opening lines of any Christmas song to date, but just what was the message behind John Lennon and Yoko Ono's iconic track? John Lennon and Yoko Ono's 1971 track is one of the world's most popular Christmas songs, and one that also contained a political message that is still resonant to this day. But what inspired the song, and how was it made? Here's all the big facts. The song came about after more than 2 years of peace activism by John Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono, that began with bed-ins they created in March and May 1969. The song was part of an international multimedia campaign launched by the couple in December 1969, at the height of the counterculture movement and protests against America's involvement in the Vietnam War. They had rented billboard spaces in 12 major cities around the world for the display of black and white posters that declared, "War is over if you want it. Happy Christmas from John and Yoko." The slogan had previously appeared in the 1968 anti-war songs, "The War is Over" by Phil Ochs and "The Unknown Soldier" by The Doors. However, it is not known if this was deliberate or merely coincidental. Lennon came up with the song as a way of continuing the themes of social unity and peaceful change via personal accountability. That was previously the basis of the earlier billboard campaign. While attempting to convey optimism and avoiding the sentimentality he felt often characterised Christmas music, he was the first Beatle to release an original Christmas song after they had parted ways.
This is Diana again. I listen to The Shepherd's Farewell by Berlioz. This is my favourite Christmas music. I am handing over to Geoffrey to read the information, as I'm afraid I'm not a French speaker.
Berlioz composed an organ piece for his friend Joseph Louis Duc called L'Adieu des Bergers, The Shepherd's Farewell. He soon turned it into a choral movement for the shepherds saying goodbye to the baby Jesus as he leaves Bethlehem for Egypt. Berlioz had the chorus performed as a hoax on 12th of November 1850, passing it off as the work of an imaginary 17th century composer, Ducre. He was gratified to discover many people who hated his music were taken and appraised it, one lady even going so far as to say, "Berlioz would never be able to write a tune as simple and charming as this little piece by old Ducre." He then added a piece for tenor, Le Repos de la Sainte Famille, The Repose of the Holy Family, and preceded both movements with an overture to former work he called La Fuite en Égypte. It was published in 1852 and first performed in Leipzig in December 1853. The premiere was so successful, Berlioz's friends urged him to expand the piece, and he had a new section, L'Arrivée à Saïs, The Arrival at Saïs, which included parts for Mary and Joseph. Berlioz, perhaps feeling the result was still a little unbalanced, then composed a third section to precede the other two, La Songe d'Hérode, Herod's Dream. Berlioz's music was usually received with great hostility by Parisian audiences and critics, who generally accused it of being bizarre and discordant. Yet L'Enfance du Christ was an immediate success and was praised by all but two critics in the Paris newspapers. Some attributed its favourable reception to a new, gentler style, a claim Berlioz vigorously rejected. The work has maintained its popularity, it is often performed around Christmas, and many recordings have been made of it.
Jeremy here. As you know, Gillian cannot be with us today, but she did send us a contribution. Her favourite hymn is the hymn, O Holy Night, the stars are brightly shining, it is the night of our dear Saviour's birth. Sorry, I can't sing anymore. This hymn dates back to the mid-19th century. Placide Capot, a French poet, wrote the lyrics, and the music was composed by Adolphe Adam, a French composer. Capot was an atheist, and Adam was also a non-believer. Emily Laurie, an opera singer, first performed the piece on Christmas Eve in 1847 in Roquemaure, a small town in southern France. The Catholic Church initially banned O Holy Night because of its non-Christian origin. It was eventually performed at a Christmas Eve service in 1906 by Reginald Fessenden. He was a radio pioneer. The broadcast was one of the first instances of a musical broadcast over the radio. It continues to resonate with people today.
Hello, it's Anne-Marie again, and I have chosen In the Bleak Midwinter, a Christmas carol based on a poem by the English poet Christina Rossetti. The poet was published under the title A Christmas Carol in the January 1872 issue of Scribner's Monthly. The poem first appeared set to music in the English hymnal in 1906 with a setting by Gustav Holst. Harold Dark's anthem setting of 1911 is more complex and was named the best Christmas carol in a poll of some of the world's leading choir masters and choral experts in 2008. This leads me into my next reading. I would like to read a poem to you and then share my thoughts on the links that exist between birds, berries, and winter traditions. This is a poem for winter. I have chosen to read this poem because the first time I had the pleasure of reading poetry aloud, it was for this magazine. The poet was Christina Rossetti. Since then, I have loved her poetry. She is best known for her ballads, devotional and romantic poems, also for her long narrative poems and children's verse. Christina Rossetti's poetry has been described as pre-Raphaelite. It has rich and precise natural detail, a use of symbols and poignancy. Although her brother, Dante Gabriel, was one of the founders of the movement, she was never a member. She did write for their magazine, The Germ, however. The poem I'm going to recite is mischievous, teasing, and like many of hers, it focuses around the idea of secrets and mysteries to be revealed. There is a sense of her holding something back. Will we learn her secret, or is she just playing with us? The title has been my secret, but now it will be Christina Rossetti's. It was composed on the 23rd of November, 1857, when she was 26 years old, and first published in 1862. Her brother William Michael wrote of the poem. This was at first named nonsense, but if there is method in some madness, there may be nous in some nonsense. Christina Rossetti, Winter, My Secret. I tell my secret. No, indeed, not I. Perhaps someday, who knows? But not today. It froze and blows and snows, and you're too curious. Fie. You want to hear it? Well, Only my secret's mine and I won't tell. Or after all, perhaps there's none. Suppose there is no secret after all, but only just my fun. Today's a nipping day, a biting day, in which one wants a shawl, a veil, a cloak, and other wraps. I cannot ope to everyone who taps and let the draughts come whistling through my hall. Come bounding and surrounding me, come buffeting, astounding me, nipping and clipping through my wraps and all. I wear my mask for warmth. Whoever shows his nose to Russian snows, to be pecked at by every wind that blows, you would not peck. I thank you for goodwill. Believe, but leave that truth untested still. Spring's an expansive time, yet I don't trust March with its peck of dust, nor April with its rainbow-crowned brief showers, nor even May, whose flowers one frost may wither through the sunless hours. Perhaps some languid summer day, when drowsy birds sing less and less, and golden fruit is ripening to excess. If there's not too much sun, nor too much cloud, and the warm wind is neither still nor loud, perhaps my secret I may say, or you may guess. Birds, berries, and winter traditions. For many years, I was fortunate to live in a Gothic-styled Victorian house. To reach the front door, you had to descend steep steps surrounded by a tangle of ferns, holly, and ivy-coloured trees. The entrance hall was dark and cavernous. Each winter, we brightened the darkness with glossy holly leaves hung over picture frames and mirrors, my children adding sparkling silver glitter to the leaves and berries, to be discovered between the floorboards for many months to come. Whenever I hear the folk carol, the holly and the ivy, I am taken back to those years when my children were young. The lyrics reflect an association between holly, holy, and Christmas time, dating back at least as far as the medieval period, although the song can only be traced to the early 19th century. Berries provide a vital food source for birds during cold winter months. Holly berries are especially important as they are high in fat, so helping to keep them warm. So now I am thinking, should I have been cutting holly to bring inside? Helen MacDonald, in her book Vesper Flights, writes, and so answers my question. Berries grow to be eaten, not used for interior decoration. Most, packed with fats and carbohydrates around the seeds at their hearts, have evolved as vegetable offerings to birds. Some even contain alkaloid compounds toxic to mammals. Passing through avian digestive systems, the seeds are carried far and wide before being deposited in droppings to take root and flourish. The little lights of haws, the fat, dusty globes of sloes amongst blackthorn needles, hips like miniature lamps, the tiny apple handfuls of rowans and white beans. And then the weirder berries, like the pale, jellied orbs of mistletoe or spindleberries, the last looking as if Poochie decided to make tiny popcorn ornaments out of pink and orange wax. Black caps, plump little warblers, adore mistletoe berries. They pick away at their sticky flesh until their beaks are covered in goo, then clean them on branches where the seeds adhere and grow. In recent years, German blackcaps that have started spending winters here rather than in Africa may be directly responsible for spreading mistletoe to new areas of the British Isles. In early winter, mistle thrushes turn full smaug. They'll claim possession of particularly fine yew trees, hollies, mistletoe clumps, or bushes full of berries, and defend them against intruders, chasing them away with strident football rattle calls of fury. The better they defend their hoard, the earlier and more successful their breeding attempts tend to be the following spring. A tradition with the holly tree is that a good crop of berries is a warning of a hard winter on its way. This tradition probably arose out of the fondness shown by birds, especially thrushes. In fact, a bumper crop of berries is not an augury of bad weather to come, but the result of a fine summer just past. Those scarlet berries are toxic to humans and mammals. Mistletoe is another berry which we should probably leave on the tree. However, kissing under the mistletoe is a much-loved Christmas tradition, making this plant familiar to us all. It grows as a parasite on trees, hanging off branches in large balls during the winter, floating in lifeless trees and growing from thin air. In past times, it has been thought of as magical. In Norse legend, the goddess Freyja declared mistletoe a symbol of love. The Romans associated it with peace, love and understanding, hanging it over doorways to protect the household. In the Christian era, mistletoe became associated with Christmas as a decoration under which lovers were expected to kiss. Throughout the Middle Ages, it continued to be thought of as a symbol of fertility and vitality. It was also thought to protect from witches and demons. The custom of kissing under the mistletoe became popular among servants in 18th century England, but it was during the Victorian era that it became firmly established. The mistle thrush is named for its liking for mistletoe berries, mistle being an old name for the plant. Finally, what could the profusion of ivy that tangled its way down to my front door offer birds during winter? Helen MacDonald again. Wood pigeons feast on the black fruits of ivy, clambering awkwardly on thin twigs and later depositing bright purple droppings under their roosts. As winter progresses, some berries ferment and become alcoholic, and it's not uncommon to see faintly disoriented birds wandering around beneath affected shrubs. Perhaps this is the reason why birds occasionally lost their way down my chimney, creating enough noise and soot to be Father Christmas himself.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. That brings us virtually to the end of this edition, but not before I have thanked all our readers and contributors and politely reminded you to return your pouches to us. Please remember there is also a website and an app where this recording can be heard, www.eastdevontalkingnewspaper.co.uk. We are not, however, quite at an end, however. Several people from East Devon have taken the time to record their Christmas greetings for you. These include the MP for Honiton and Sidmouth, Richard Ford. Messages have also been recorded by Chris Lockyer, Amrit Singh, Stuart Hughes and Susan Trimble. These people often appear in local newspapers due to the work they carry out in the East Devon community. Before you hear these recordings, I would like to wish you, on behalf of everyone here, a safe, happy winter and a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Hey, hi, it's Stuart Hughes, the Cabinet Member for Devon County Council's Highway Management and Sidmouth's County Councillor, wishing all the East Devon subscribers of the Talking Magazine a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Take care.
Hello, I'm Susan Tribble. I'm the Lady Chair of the Newton Poppleford and Hartford Parish Council. On behalf of all my councillors and myself, I'd like to wish you a very Merry Christmas and a happy and healthy New Year.
Hello, my name is Amrik Singh. I'm the Mayor of Seaton in Devon, and I would like to wish all the listeners a very happy Christmas and a prosperous New Year. Love and peace to all.
Hello, it's Chris Lockyer here. I'm Chair of Sidmouth Town Council, and I'm delighted to be able to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Hello there, my name is Richard Ford, and I'm your Member of Parliament, the MP for Honiton and Sidmouth. And that includes much of East Devon, also Ottery St Mary, Axminster and Seaton. I have been the MP for the Honiton area for the last 2 years, and I'm talking to you and the Talking Magazine today because I wanted to let you know that every 6 weeks I have an opportunity to address the minister responsible for equalities. And I like to be able to ask questions of the minister around issues of sight loss and hearing loss. And if these are issues that you feel ought to be raised with government, then and I am your voice for doing that. I wanted to let you know that you can get in touch with me in a variety of ways. You can write to me in the House of Commons. You can have somebody perhaps write an email to me, richard.ford.mp@parliament.uk. I'll say that again, richard.ford.mp@parliament.uk. My surname is spelt with two O's, so Ford is F-O-O-R-D. You could leave me a voicemail, 0207-219-8349. And lastly, given that Christmas is rapidly approaching, I wanted to wish you a very happy Christmas and a prosperous and healthy New Year. Thank you.